comes your way.
Good morning. This is Dina Colbert.
And this is Bill DeFazio, and that's the great Sonny Rollins with East Broadway Rundown, and Sonny is in town. Try to catch him.
City Watch is a watchdog for social, economic, political, and cultural issues in New York City.
Thanks for all the responses to my question on the singers in the Camelots. Gary, Bruce, Howie all responded, so I know who the Camelots were or are. I hope they're all still alive. Davy Nichols, Spanish Joe, Shifty, and Bright. Shout out to all of you guys. And the Buccaneers with Frankie Jackson, Stanley Dickinson, Sal LaRusso, and Juan Gomez. Schoolyard music was a great experience for those of us who grew up on the streets of New York. Feel free to tell me about your neighborhood groups, and if you have selections from those wonderful singing groups, we will play them on City Watch. Just call me at 718-389-1018. Vito and the Salutations have already got in touch with me, Old Brownsville Group, through Jeff Ambers from Yorkville Common Pantry. A good place to donate some money. They always need money at Yorkville. With that, take it, Dina.
A preview of today's show is that we will have Woody Henderson, who's running for the New York City Council seat in District 9. He's the person who will replace Bill Perkins. And then we'll have Dr. Rod Bush, author of We Are Not What We Seem, Black Nationalism and Class Struggle in the American Century, from New York Press and professor at St. John's University. He will speak on the new politically correct racism and possible solutions. And in studio, we have spoken word artist Jackie Sheeler and
Mark DiGirolamo.
Sorry about that, Mark.
Sorry, I'm sorry too. I called him Mike.
I've been called a lot worse.
So, Jackie's been with us on a number of occasions, and we're here to celebrate an upcoming release of her new CD.
For Talk Engine.
Jackie.
Western sun down, down, down into an obscenity of fish. In the desert, nothing wriggles. My hand emerges from its hot, gloved, and spotless skin. The pilot returns to the cabin. I smell his fear. At cruising altitude, thousands of feet above the clouds, we face Mecca. To left, right, front, back, it is Mecca. It is always time to pray. Stuffed overhead, there's my people. said so many things. This is what God wants.
Oh, that's my kind of stuff, Jackie. That's just great. The music is spectacular also. Wow.
Isn't it fabulous? We have Talk Engine is a great group of musicians. Everybody's really experimental and really willing to try to go out on a limb and to take risks. That particular track, At Prayer, that's the track number 8 on the CD that we're releasing on September 9th, is actually about Egypt Air Flight 800. And it was actually written in response to a Daily News article that gave a transcript of the black box recording from when that plane went down. This is the case where the co-pilot was some terrorist and he shut the engines off when the pilot went to the bathroom. And I found the black box transcript so chilling that I wrote a poem about it that was later published. But it's hard to find musicians that are willing to take risks with material like that because it is kind of edgy and outer spacey. And musicians like Mark DiGirolamo, our guitarist, our incredible guitarist who's in the studio here with me today, does take risks and welcomes, engaging, challenging material. And that's just so fabulous for us as artists. We help each other grow.
Why don't we just go to a little Jimmy Jones? It took me a long time to find this cut. And then we'll get back to Jackie in a second, okay? And Mark.
Hey girl, gather round, because of what I'm putting down. Baby, I'm still a handyman. I'm not the kind that used to be to a rule. I'm handy with the love and I'm no fool. I fix broken hearts, I know I really can. If you're I'm busy 24 hours a day. I fix broken hearts, I know I really can.
That's the great Jimmy Jones. He's kind of one of those great performers of the late 50s, early 60s, who's disappeared. He wrote Handyman, and most of you probably know Handyman not from Jimmy Jones, even though this was a number 3 Billboard hit. You know it from God, I'm blacking on his name. Well, it doesn't matter who it is. James Taylor. I'm blacking on James Taylor. A lot of people know it from James Taylor, but James Taylor did not write this song. Jimmy Jones wrote it. Okay, with that, Dina, take it.
We're scheduled to have Woody Henderson, who's running for the New York City Council seat in District 9, with us here in the studio. And I think he's been delayed. He's doing a press conference
at City Hall.
And so in the meantime, we will spend a little more time with Jackie Sheeler and Mark DiGirolamo and talk about Talk Engine. How long has Talk Engine been in process?
It's about 2 years. We did release a single last summer called Something for Junior, which was in honor of George Bush's last summer in the White House, and we were all very sad that it didn't actually work out that way. The CD that we're releasing this month is it's entitled Talk Engine. It's 14 tracks. It's a full-length CD. We all worked very hard on it, and we are very proud of it. We're delighted to be releasing it on actually Friday, September 9th. We'll be at the Tribeca Rock Club. That's 16 Warren Street, downtown New York. We'd love to see you there. We're going to put on an hour show. We'll have CDs available. And, you know, we're on the radio, so of course we have to be somewhat conservative and abide by, you know, the FCC guidelines, which, of course, we gladly do. I will just say that in live shows, there's no guidelines to abide by, and we take things to the wall.
What do you mean by word rock? You're a word rock band.
Well, you know, we are rock and roll's answer to hip-hop, Bill, because it's spoken word with rock and roll. Whereas rap is, you know, spoken word with hip-hop beats, we are spoken word with straight-up rock and roll beats. Now, maybe that wasn't too evident from the first track that we played, because That Prayer is kind of an experimental. I mean, but we have... You know, we've got surf pieces and we've got the blues ballads, and but it's all spoken word. It's not sung, although they're structured as songs. So I think that makes Talk Engine entirely unique. And that is the feedback we've been getting. We're getting a lot of play on the internet, and we're in a lot of podcasts, and we've been getting a lot of emails and responses from people who all say, I love this, but I've never heard anything like it before. And that's, of course, exactly what we want to hear.
So, with that, let's hear another piece from the two of you since you're live in studio. This is Jackie Sheeler and Mark DiGirolamo from Talk Engine.
And this piece, I'll just say it's a little, this is a new series that we're working on, which is just acoustic, just me and Mark. So this is a little softer, called Picture of a Child on a Chair. My feet don't reach the floor. I'm stranded where they placed me. I watch the photographer in his stiff black suit, fussing over the bulbs, covering his head. My lacy dress smells of rose water. I like it better when no one can see me. I prefer to be always unwatched. Underneath my full white skirt is Daddy's leather belt. Strapping me down, I am fastened to the chair. I cannot fall. Dust rises around me, old and thick like Daddy. I wish for the flash of bulbs and then at last release. I like it better when no one can see me underneath my full white skirt. Daddy's leather belt is strapping me down. Strapping me down.
Wow.
That's kind of an oblique slant on child abuse inspired by an old-time postcard.
Absolutely.
We could do something a little more upbeat if you would like.
Well, I was thinking that we would play that track 3 from the new album, if that's
excellent
all right.
Excellent choice. It is an anti-war track I think your listeners will appreciate.
Recruit, and God help you if you preach. Salute, recruit, and fall home. I turn on my TV to watch a drama. And listen to the war makers applauding. The man with the nerve to pull out all the stuff. Somewhere in my heart a pulse is beat, 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 beating. And somewhere some of the hearts ain't never gonna be.
Wonderful album. We'll get back to Jackie in a second, but we do have Woody Henderson, who's running for New York City Council District 9 to replace Bill Perkins. And Dina, why don't you introduce Woody?
Woody Henderson is founder and president of the Organization for Reunification and Rehabilitation of Children and Families. He's also a former court-appointed special advocate, vice president of the Columbus House Tenants Association, and Vice President of PS9 PTA. Woody also served as an aide to Reverend Al Sharpton and President of the New York Chapter of the National Action Network. Welcome, Woody Henderson.
Thank you, Dina.
As part of your history here, I see that you have been responsible for writing and compiling resolutions for over 20 members of the City Council, and that they've both endorsed, co-sponsored, and adopted many of these issues. Among other things, they call for the appointment of a special federal prosecutor to look into the unfair and unconstitutional ways the family courts and ACS deal with family, with children and families in their care. Could you tell us more about that effort on your part?
Yes. In my opinion, the most devastating thing in my community, the most important issue in my community is the crisis in the child welfare system. 98% of the children in foster care are African American or Latino. 75% of them end up in penal institutions. 67% of them never graduate high school. 60% of those that make up the homeless shelters are former foster children, and 1 in 6 girls become pregnant while in their care between the ages of 13 and 21. If that same type of a thing was happening in the greater community, in the white community, there would be an uproar that would shake the very foundations of New York. So I believe that if you're going to take someone's children because you're accusing them of neglect or abuse, you have a responsibility at the very least to provide a better level of protection than that from which you're taking them. And these statistics show that they're not. So what I'm trying to do, these resolutions that I was responsible for writing and compiling that were endorsed and introduced by over 20 members of the city council say that I'm, first of all, capable of writing legislation, and secondly, that I'm capable of getting members of city council to work with me for issues that will positively impact Harlem and District 9 and subsequently New York City as a whole. Another important part of that is the problem with the family courts, because family courts is unconstitutional, because the Sixth Amendment says that every person has a right to confront his accuser. Well, that right's not afforded people in family court. Someone could falsely accuse you of being neglectful or abusive to your child, and you can simply ask the question, well, who accused me of this? And they will tell you that we can't tell you. That's unconstitutional. So what's happening is that the mayor appoints the judges in family court, the mayor appoints the commissioner of ACS, and by proxy, the mayor appoints the general counsel of family court. Therefore, the person who removes the child from the parent is appointed by the mayor. The person who tries the parent for neglect or abuse is appointed by the mayor. And the judge that decides on whether the person is guilty or not is appointed by the mayor. Too much power for one person to have, whether it's Giuliani or Mayor Dinkins. That the judges in family court need to be elected, and that's one of the things that we call for. So we're asking for a special federal prosecutor to look into the unconstitutionality and the unfair and unjust ways that children are being taken from their families. And far too often, only 25% are what they call abuse cases, high-risk cases. 75% are low-risk, so there's another way to deal with it.
Now, there are a lot of good people running for the city council in the 9th District to replace Bill Perkins, who's been one of the most important and progressive city council members over the last, 12 years or something. Why should the people of Harlem pick you over those other 8 or 9 people?
Well, for one, I have been out on the front lines in the struggle for justice and equal rights, fighting for affordable housing. I've been out on the street putting my life on the line for issues that impact people in a community that's been devastated far too long. I have some ideas that are very progressive and, as some people say, even revolutionary in the sense of affordable housing. One of the things that I think we can do is to take or use eminent domain to repossess properties that's controlled by the city in abandoned or buildings that they've had sitting there vacant for decades. Corporations or institutions like Columbia University that's been controlling so much property. I believe that we can use eminent domain to take a portion of that property to provide affordable housing for low and middle income people. The fight on the firehouse, for instance, something that I've been very much involved in. In fact, I just left the steps of City Hall in a press conference. So I'm already doing the work. That's one of the important things.
You've been particularly involved in Engine Company 30, right?
36, yes.
36,
which was closed on 125th Street. And what's happened, and I said this over a year and a half ago, that something sinister was going on with the closing of these firehouses. A mayor who would spend $70 million to become mayor of a city and saying because he loved that city, but is not willing to invest $6 million to keep 6 firehouses open that would protect the safety of the lives and the property of people in this city. Something is wrong with that. When those fires burn, when a fire burns, and because of the loss of the firehouses, the engine companies, which puts the water on the fire, not the trucks. A fire truck just has ladders to do rescue and other issues. Only the fire engines, people don't understand. So when they do response time, it should only be the response time of the engines. And when you do that, the 25 seconds that are lost, the houses burn, the people who live in these houses are displaced, and when they're replaced, the houses are rebuilt or new facilities are put there, it's never brought back as affordable housing. One of the ways that my community has lost housing, and that's one of the other things, that they need a voice in city council that's not afraid to speak truth to power and stand up to city hall bullies and state officials.
Now, I know that you were PTA president in your district for a number of years, and that you know how to work with parents and teachers because that's what the job was at the time. The question would be, we at City Watch have been following the campaign for fiscal equity lawsuit for years now, very closely. I'm wondering what, as city council, you could give to your district in education that would help benefit your district specifically.
Specifically, my district is impacted by a lack of quality schools. That's one thing. One of the things that I'm going to be pushing very hard for is to have two high schools built in Harlem in District 9. One, a vocational school, the other, a technical school. I think these are very important. I think it's something society has gotten away from for some reason. For instance, my daughter went to Brooklyn Tech. It's ridiculous that she had to travel that distance to go to school. A school like a quality technical school or a quality vocational school would do so much for the self-esteem of the community itself, would do so much to offer alternatives. Everyone doesn't want to be a doctor, a lawyer, or a candlestick maker. There are other options out there. We need apprenticeship programs. By bringing in two new schools, high schools, that would in itself reduce the number of students in the classrooms, which is key. Because when you have crowded classrooms, you've got students sitting up on each other. They're children in most cases. They're playing with each other. By giving them some space, some elbow room, by giving teachers a chance to do what they really are there for, because they obviously are not there to make money, because they're not paid what they're worth. So by reducing the class sizes, taking the police out of the school, that's a hostile environment. Having police in schools, having metal detectors, and then having police in schools is taking away from the stability of the schools. Those are some of the areas that would like to change. And, of course, the curricula needs to be different. In spite of what people are trying to say about the mayor is trying to say about him improving the school systems and the social promotion, which I've never been in favor of. If teachers were being allowed to do the job, there would be no need for social promotion. So one of the things that I would definitely want to see happen is with the teachers. And I think Charles Barron said it very well when the mayor was talking about the problems in school and putting a policeman next to every child if he have to get order in school. That shows his mentality. As Charles Barron said, what he should be doing is putting a computer next to every student, putting a book, quality book, putting teachers, giving space to students so they can have elbow room and I can't just touch the next person next to me. If the city had a serious interest in the development of the children, and that's why I say the children is the most important issue in this race. I think we often forget it. We get so busy looking at the whole picture that we fail to see the whole in the picture. And that whole is our children. And everything in that picture is connected to our children, whether it's affordable housing, a lack of health care, whether it's the crime and criminal justice system, whether it's unemployment. It's all connected. Education, it's all connected to our children. We like to say, oh, the children are our future. Don't leave no children behind. All of these things that sound good, but they do nothing to change society. Those on the upper echelon, the rich people in our society, who may not have such a vested interest in public school, they need to understand that their children's lives are connected to the children in the poorest of communities. When you lift the bottom of society, the top automatically rises. So it's in their best interest to look out for my children. Their children have to go to school with them. They're going to have to work with them. They're going to have to live in a society with them. And hopefully, they won't have to serve in any more unjust wars with them.
The New England Journal of Medicine has run a series of articles on the continued discrimination against African American patients in the medical system in the United States. We see this in Harlem in terms of care for asthma and HIV/AIDS patients. What should we do? Is Harlem Hospital sufficient? How do we create better health care for African Americans in a society that's very biased against African Americans?
Well, one of the things is providing more resources for a hospital like Harlem Hospital, and we certainly can't leave out another great hospital, which is North General, which is also in the district. One of the things, the asthma issue, I've been working with that, and I have been part of city council. I've testified in front of the city council on that particular issue. It's one of the things that the closing of the firehouses had an impact on, because firefighters often were called out to help these kids. Many of them children, 1 in 4 children in Harlem have asthma, the highest rate in the country. It's ridiculous. But with all of the bus depots there, the garbage transport systems that they have there, that community is so congested, and it's probably the biggest booming community now in the city. Harlem is growing like crazy, and that's going to the environment is getting worse because of all the additional pollution that's being put in, the additional cars and the other things that's going in there. So one of the things that we can do is provide more resources for a Harlem hospital to make it more of a teaching school, to provide more opportunities for some of the students. The idea has to always come back to education, and education as it relates to our children, and a quality education, because one of those kids running around the street that's not motivated to stay in school because of the deplorable conditions in those schools. One of those children, God may have already planted the seed for the cure for cancer in his mind, in his brain, and we're not letting this come out. People need to be motivated. So many people have become frustrated and by the Bush administration, the Bush doctrine of greed over need.
We have only time for one more question. I'm sorry to have to cut your interview short because I know you spent a busy morning as it is. Given that we have about a minute left, what would you, as one of many who are running in your district, like to say to the residents of District 9 that you will provide and fight for as council member should you be elected?
Should I be elected, I will certainly fight for affordable housing, for changing. One of the things that I would fight for would be to put a profit tax on the large corporation and developers that come into the community. What I believe is that it's not just the tax breaks, it's not just the subsidies that these corporations get to develop and to build in Harlem. The reason they're coming to Harlem is because Harlem is a tremendous source of consumption. We consume so much in that community. So what I would do would be put a profit tax. In other words, when corporations reach a certain level of profit, that all of the profits above that, a certain portion of those profits would be set aside in an escrow account to offset the tax burden on the people in the community and the small businesses. This is only fair because they are making additional profits, like the outsourcing, people that are outsourcing business, so we're losing jobs. One of the reasons perhaps there's a 50% lack of employment among black men. When these people are outsourcing and then bringing these things back into the city, I believe there's a way that we can charge a reentry tax to help offset some of these burdens. I have a TV show called A Struggle for Justice that comes on every Monday night at 10 o'clock on Channel 34, and it can also be picked up on the internet. It's at MNN.org. But every Monday night, and I'm doing an issue now called Let the People Speak, because the people have the answers.
How do people reach you?
They can reach me either at my website at juststruggle.com, a just struggle, because that's what we're involved in, or by phone, 212-222-7490. And if they should forget that, just go to information and ask them for Woody Henderson, because I will always be listed.
Thank you, Woody Henderson.
Thank you so much, Woody.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Danny Glover, and you're tuned in to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
WBAI has an elected local station board comprised of staff and listeners. For the schedule of meetings of the board and its committees, visit the website www.wbai.org/lsb or call 212-209-2919. That's www.wbai.org/lsb or 212-209-2919. Meetings are generally open with time for public comment and are wheelchair accessible. Get involved. It's our station.
You're listening to City Watch. This is Dina Colbert.
And this is Bill DeFazio.
And this is 99.5 FN WBAI, your peace and justice radio.
A little reverb, I heard that.
We have a little reverb because we have Jackie Sheeler and Mark DiGirolamo in the studio, and we're going to hear another piece from them.
This is an acoustic version of a track on the record called Boy Girl.
Boy Girl.
She always said she was the boy. I didn't know it meant she'd leave like one, swagger through the wreckage behind her affair with an unfond farewell and 24 unreturned calls. She always said she was the boy. Even though I'm the one who showed up with the strap on stiff under my zipper. She stripped and she spread, giggling. Girlish, I lowered over her, dipped in again and again and again and again. Months after the split, I still find long strands of hair curling at the baseboards. Smudges of her secret eye, pencil blurring the vanity mirror. I kept her cards and letters, the photos, our thing. Kept her dwindling heart. Found another box cold enough to keep that sorry little thing alive in slow beats of hypothermia, just like her miserly love. She always said she was the boy. Squeezing her two faces into my life and then pulling them out. Quick, lovers interrupt us. The girls I example a hard-hearted malehood. Handsome outside, poisoned inside. Just the kind of boy. Just the kind of boy, just the kind of boy that I would never lay myself down with, never again, never again.
That's Talk Engine with Jackie Sheeler and Mark DiGirolamo.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Yes.
And now we have online Dr. Rod Bush. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, let me introduce you properly. Dr. Rod Bush is author of We Are Not What We Seem, Black Nationalism and Class Struggle in the American Century by NU Press. He is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at St. John's University. He spent most of his adult life in the movement for black liberation and social change. And he is presently writing another book called The End of White World Supremacy, Black Internationalism, and the Problem of the Color Line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks
for that introduction.
You know, on the way down in the subway, as I was standing, as I always do, in the cattle pen, I noticed a ad for Metro Health Plus, and it was for free and low-cost health insurance, and I think it's a wonderful thing. But then I looked at the picture, and there were these six beautiful people, all of color. And I thought in its own way that this was both class and race issues, that people, it's so subtle, people don't even get it. That does that mean that no white people are poor or need free health insurance? I don't think that's the case. So that was just my little morning wake-up call on the way in. But let me ask you to begin with, have we created a permanent underclass as we demand highly skilled and educated workers and new business as new business owners in the black middle class reach a new level, what do we do with this permanent underclass?
Well, if I had to answer to that one, I think that the situation is that in terms of people who are relegated to the bottom of the economic ladder in the United States and elsewhere, is that these people have tended to be people of color. And there's a long historical explanation for that. It is rooted in the enslavement of African people, in the colonization of the northern part of Mexico, of the Philippines, of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and so that the social relations of domination and subordination have been overlain by the race issue, and so that the class issue is very important. The class issue cuts across racial lines, but partly in the forming of a system of hegemony, that the race issue is used to gain the consent of whites for the extremes of poverty that people of color suffer from. And they then form something like a cross-class alliance with the elites who don't care as much about them as they think, as they may think. I think most folks know this. But it's a way of forming a system of domination in which they attempt to purchase the consent of the white working people and middle classes for the extremes of poverty, and say that it affects people of color because they are lacking in the cultural capital and so forth, to be able to assimilate properly into the mainstream of American society. And it's a myth, of course, but it unfortunately works all too often.
In the first week of August, Rod, to just change this a little bit. In the first week of August, in reaction to a racist statement made about Caribbean baseball players on the San Francisco Giants, the manager of the San Francisco Giants, Felipe Alou, and I'm paraphrasing here, said something to the effect of, "I thought this was over, that the racism was over, but maybe it never left, or maybe it's coming back." When I called this segment politically correct racism, my sense is that the Bush administration has created an atmosphere in this country. Maybe it's not as bad as the Cowan, the kind of the murders of the Black Panthers in the 1960s and that kind of overt racism of the early 60s, or the middle 60s, but it seems that there's an atmosphere where racism is becoming all right again. And I think that Felipe Alou is right. It's coming back just like it was before. What do you think about that?
Well, I would have to sadly agree with him. The reasoning is, racism, of course, is not new. And, of course, we know about slavery. We know about the post-slavery period in which there was a period of Reconstruction and the freed people attempted to construct solutions to the problem of racism in the United States. Now, I can't go over the whole long period of that, but I think one thing that happened and the federal government, if you look back at the struggles against lynch mob, and the riot mob, and so forth, you'll see that the federal government basically played a hands-off role, which allowed racist whites to pursue their own interests in terms of dampening the ability of people of color, in particular blacks, to compete effectively with them in the labor market. But in the 1940s, when the U.S. was moving up in the world and beginning to, in terms of the elites, to try to vie with Germany for leadership of the so-called free world, then they began to pursue a policy of nations, of a nation of nations. That is, if you look both at Henry Luce, who articulated the concept of the American century, at the Wallaceites, who talked about the century of the common man, they all had this idea that the United States was a nation of nations. Luce wanted to prove that it was a nation of nations and that it accepted everyone and that it was the exemplary nation to be the leader of the world, and it could prove that everybody could be accepted. And if you look at Gunnar Myrdal's The American Dilemma, and in all of its thousands of pages, you'll see that that's a lot of what he's talking about, what they're talking about, that the U.S. has to prove that it can accept everybody. So that this this 1940s period is very important in terms of being a preliminary to the modern civil rights movement. And as you know, there were some of WBAI's readers, listeners, will probably know that in the 1940s, there was a struggle over this whole idea of what would constitute a proper black freedom struggle, struggle against racial exclusion amongst different sections of the black movement, and of course among the elites who had a vested interest in restricting the kind of demands and programs that developed. So on the one hand, you had people such as the black left, Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, sometimes called the Black Popular Front, who argued that the African-American people suffered from not only internal racism, but they suffered from a racism that was in some ways identical or similar to the colonial problem that people in the worlds of color outside of the U.S. suffered from, and that systematically it was similar. So you had that on the one hand. Then you had the more moderate leaders of the civil rights movement, like Walter White, Ralph Bunche, and so forth, Roy Wilkins and so forth, who argued that, well, we should restrict our focus to the internal realm within United States society, and that we should use the U.S.'s concern about its image to, in a sense, blackmail them so that they could, and to argue that in terms of the struggle against communism, that the United States had to prove.
You're going to have to, kind of complete it quickly so okay. We can get one more question, and we're running out of time.
Oh, God, I'm sorry. Okay, so anyway, so this image then, this need to prove this is what I think spurred the elites to deal with the issue of civil rights. And then the civil rights movement then began to take the high road in terms of being nonviolent and loving your enemy and so forth. And it seized the imagination, rightfully so, of the American people. And so for that period in the 1960s, There was a large consensus which supported the rights of people of color, and the there was some sentiment that discrimination against blacks should end.
Okay. Dr. Bush, let me change the subject. Bill and I have discussed many of the social and economic injustices in the African American movement over many years now. This is an area that I haven't heard discussion of, and I don't even know whether it's something that you're comfortable in talking about. But I was looking at Social Security and the issues of Bush trying to privatize that, and I realized what racial injustices there were since black males live only to 66 years and Social Security starts at 65, so they get 1 year in. Black females live to 72, so they only get 5 years of benefits, where white females live to 78 years, they get 13 years of benefits. White males live to 76 years. These are averages, so they get 11 years of benefits. So that's pretty clear that there is a racism built into the system. And yet we know the system has been beneficial to those who have accrued Social Security. Do you believe that the seeds of investment that privatization would cause African American families, so that over many generations they would accrue monies that in the past they haven't been able to, would be a way for African Americans to go?
You're saying the privatization of Social Security?
Correct.
Would be something that would benefit African Americans?
Would it more so?
More so than the current system?
Correct.
Well, you know, like, I'm not an expert on Social Security, but I would say that the privatization of Social Security would lead, it would be a continuation of what we have in the economic realm in general, is that those people who have would get more, and those people who don't have and who are not familiar with investment would get less, and they would, but they would also be less secure. You know, this is the general problem.
You have 30
seconds.
Class
society. General problem in a class society where the people who have more get more, the people who have less get less, and so I don't see privatization at all as a solution to the problem that African Americans or any of us have with Social Security.
I'm sorry, Rod, but we're going to have to have you on again. We'll talk more about this in more detail at some time in the future. I do want to announce.
Did I answer your question?
Well, you answered it. I think you answered it pretty good.
Okay.
But let me just make one mention. There's a Labor Day workshop and rally on Saturday, September 3rd, 2005, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, 224 West Kinney Street, Newark, New Jersey. How did black construction workers and Newark residents get left out of the construction boom in Newark? Call Wilbert Carnegie for further information. His number is 973-941-6698. That's Wilbert Carnegie. 973-941-6698. This is obviously a topic we're going to have to deal with on the show at some time. Dina.
Talk Engine with Jackie Sheeler and Mike DiGirolamo. Mark, are having, come join us Friday, September 9th at 10 p.m. at the Tribeca Rock Club, 16 Warren Street between Broadway and Church. And come enjoy the Talk Engine's party for their release of their new CD. We want to thank Jackie Sheeler and Mark DiGirolamo. I'm sorry to mess
so
up your name.
For us,
Woody
Dean.
Henderson for
Rod,
coming down
here
in person. Errol Maitland, our engineer.
Rod Bush.
Dr. Rod Bush for being with us. This is Dina Colbert.
We're not on next week, folks. They're having the Supreme Court hearings for Roberts. So we'll be on in 2 weeks. Listen for us in 2 weeks, please. Bill DeFazio.
Thank you, Louis. You forgot to thank Louis, Dr. Professor Bill DeFazio. How could you do that? But of course, they'll be back after the Supreme Court hearing if they go off. And you know, these things are unpredictable, but nonetheless, WBAI will be here with your support. And you can catch today's City Watch, if you've missed any part of it, by going to our website, WBAI.org, and plug in and listen. You can even, I guess, download it and take it with you. Here comes the Community Bulletin Board.
The following is a list of events from the WBAI Community Bulletin Board.
Camp Casey, New York City is an ongoing 24/7 vigil in solidarity with Cindy Sheehan and Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. It's taking place at Union Square South near the subway kiosk and the George Washington Equestrian Monument in Manhattan. Bring tents, candles, flowers, banners, and signs to help reclaim this spot for the anti-war movement. For more information, call 646-549-1615. That's 646-549-1615.
Don't miss the annual West Indian Carnival Festival,